finished with the pirates, whichever came first. And finally, Pompey was entrusted as the overseer of the Roman grain supply for a period of 5 years. Pompey is now very much a popularis, a man of the people. He's looking after their food interests, and he's been commissioned with the job of ridding them of the problem of the pirates. Despite the fact he'd been given 3 years to complete his commission, so efficient was Pompey's system of dealing with the pirates that he completed the job in 3 months. He divided the Mediterranean Sea into sectors, and with his 24 lieutenants and squadrons of warships supported on the shore with squadrons of infantry, he shepherded the pirates into capture and killing zones and wiped them out. He did capture very many pirates and took many of their strong points in southern Cilicia, in rough Cilicia. And here is one of the signs of Pompey's cleverness. Rather than crucify them all or execute them as brigands, he settled them all as farmers and traders in Cilicia, where they had lived. These men then became clients of Pompey. This actually was also a feature of Pompey's settlement of Spain following his war against Sertorius, which ended at 72 BC. Rather than having executions and proscriptions, he settled the affairs of Spain very, very equitably and reasonably, and was also very popular there. So Pompey's busy building power bases for himself east and west. Well, Pompey is now in the east. His power, his imperium infinitum over the pirates has technically lapsed. But he's no desire to return home. Mithridates is still at large, and he's no particular desire to leave the matter resting there. And so, no doubt, at Pompey's suggestion and instigation, another tribune for the year 66 BC, a man called Caius Manilius, proposes a law transferring Pompey's imperium to the east, to the eastern half of the empire, basically saying he already has this vast power, let's put it to good use and finish this war against Mithridates. This is a successful ploy, and again, amid scenes of considerable disorder, the law of Manilius transferring Pompey's imperium to the eastern half of the empire to deal with the problem of Mithridates is passed in 66 BC. What we see in these 2 years is Pompey making immediate use of the restored tribunate, which he had helped bring back to its full powers in 70 BC when he was consul with Crassus. So I think that if there's any real doubt about the motives of Pompey and Crassus in restoring the pre-Sullan tribunate, the actions should speak for themselves. The actions of these years speak for themselves. Pompey benefits enormously from the newly restored tribunate. Following this transferal of his imperium to the east, Pompey spent the next 6 years fighting against Mithridates, who finally was murdered and as a result disappeared from the scene. And then he travels around the eastern half of the empire, essentially behaving like a monarch. Pompey, we hear, signs treaties, establishes alliances with foreign powers. He establishes whole provinces. The province of Syria was created at this time. He settles affairs in Judea. He negotiates, although not very successfully, with the king of the Parthians, the neighboring kingdom, who I mentioned earlier had supplanted the Seleucid, the Hellenistic Seleucid kingdom, which disappeared around 100 BC to be replaced by the native kingdom of the Parthians as Rome's eastern neighbor. In fact, Rome's only civilized neighboring state. These people traditionally had their king called the King of Kings, and Pompey pointedly refused to address him as anything other than king. Another story that has come into the general tales about Pompey's behavior in the East and is reflected in biblical literature is his behavior in Jerusalem. When he was in Jerusalem, Pompey had heard about the wonderful antiquity and great power of the Hebrew God. And of course, at this time, Judaism was very much still a temple religion, and he wanted to see the temple of this wondrous God. So he visited the temple, and of course, as you know, Gentiles were not welcome inside. Never mind inside the Sanctum Sanctorum, the inner holy of holies, in which were kept various sacred artifacts. Pompey, being a pagan, fully expected to find in the inner holy of holies, a magnificent statue of this wonderfully powerful God. Brushing past the priests, ignoring their protests, he stomped into the holy of holies, came out shaking his head, saying, what are these people talking about? All there was in there were some scrolls, ancient-looking scrolls of paper. What's the point? This was, of course, the Torah, the most sacred texts of the Jews, which Pompey couldn't understand. Why would this be what they worship? Where's the golden statue of Yahweh? A good clash of cultures there, but Pompey ever afterwards reviled in Jewish sources for this dreadful act of sacrilege. This is the sort of way he behaved when he was in the East. He behaved basically as a king would. All of this done without reference to the Senate and without any permission beyond his holding of his imperium. By 63 BC then, Pompey had completed his reorganization. He essentially established the Eastern Roman Empire in a form that it would maintain for several centuries. He certainly founded Roman power in the East on a firmer footing than it had been before. And he was finished by 63 BC and ready to return home. People were not looking forward to this. The last time a Roman general had come home from the East, we all know what happened. Crassus, meanwhile, while Pompey was busy in the East, defeating Mithridates and basically behaving like a monarch, Crassus was busy in Rome doing his best to undermine Pompey's position. He backed and proposed, through tribunes and other sources, several measures that attempted to limit or restrict Pompey's power, or at least establish some kind of a counterbalance that would be in Crassus's hands. I won't go into all the measures, because none of them succeeded, that he proposed, but I'll mention just one, for example. Internal squabblings within the dynasty of the Ptolemies in Egypt gave Crassus an opportunity to propose that Egypt be annexed as a Roman province, and he proposed, of course, one of his own creatures to be the proconsul of the new province, which would have given him at least a power base, some sort of a territorial footing against which he could maybe set up some stand against Pompey's power, but the proposal was blocked. So this is the sort of thing that Crassus was doing, trying to introduce some level of undermining for Pompey's position. But they all failed. All of his proposals failed, and Pompey's power and popularity seemed to grow greater and greater and greater. As a result, then, Crassus began to back the career of a young nobleman as a foil to Pompey's popularity. The nobleman he chose was the able and ambitious Gaius Julius Caesar. Caesar was born in 100 BC of a patrician family with impeccable lineage. He counted among his ancestors the goddess Venus, and through the son of Aeneas Iulus, the founder of the Roman people himself, Aeneas. However, the family of the Iulii Caesares had not been prominent in politics in the second century or even much before that. For while they had the best and bluest of blood in their veins, they didn't have much cash in their purses. And of course, it was precisely money that Crassus could provide for Caesar's ambitions. A good story surrounds Caesar to indicate something of his character from his youth. The story goes that around 75 BC, Caesar was visiting with a king in the East when, on his returning home, he was captured by pirates. Once more, there are those pirates. The pirates, we are told, said to Caesar that they would ransom him to his family for a fee of 20 talents, at which point Caesar burst out laughing, asked them if they had any idea who they had in their hands, and offered them 50. For the next 38 days, we hear, Caesar stayed with the pirates in their base in southern Cilicia as a prisoner, although he treated them with utter disdain and contempt. He would compose poetry and speeches for their betterment, and if they failed to understand them, he would scold them as illiterate savages. He took part in all their games, usually beating them, of course, and occasionally would joke and laugh that if they gave him any more grief, he would come back one day and hang them all to a man. The pirates thought this was hilarious and put it down to the young blood of a man in his mid-twenties. After a certain length of time, it was actually 38 days, the ransom came through and Caesar was released. Immediately upon his release, he gathered up some ships and approached the praetor in charge of the province of Asia, demanding that the pirates be arrested for their crime. When the praetor showed no interest, Caesar acted unilaterally, took his ships, hunted down the pirates, brought them back to the mainland, imprisoned them, and when the praetor refused to act any further, Caesar had them all crucified, just as he had promised in joking with them when he was their captive. The story indicates something of Caesar's temperament, a man, we are told, from very earliest period of his life, rather arrogant, with a great sense of his own importance. This is the man that Crassus backed with his money. Caesar, with Crassus's backing, rose up through the cursus in proper order. There is no sign, it must be said, right up front, that despite Plutarch's claim that Caesar was a revolutionary from birth, basically, there's no sign of any revolutionary inclinations in Caesar in his early career. He rises up in perfectly good order through the cursus honorum, through the run of offices, and in the year 63 BC wins a great honor, double honor. He is elected to the praetorship for that year, and he also is elected in an unheard of achievement as the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest of the Roman people. This was a lifetime position and was normally conferred upon a man of much older age and greater experience. So for Caesar at the tender age of 37 to be given this post was a tremendous boost to his career, because the religious offices of Rome, as we'll see in the later lecture when we look at Roman paganism, were all held by the same people who were the politicians and the generals and so forth, and the various priesthoods added to one's prestige and would help one in one's political career. So being Pontifex Maximus was a great boost to the young Caesar's career, and this he achieved in 63 BC. Still, people waited for the return of Pompey. While they were doing so, a new crisis erupted in the state. A nobleman, Lucius Sergius Catilina, Catiline in the anglicized version of his name, had three times failed to be elected to the consulship, his third and final attempt falling in the year 63 BC. Catiline lost the consular elections in this year, in the summer of this year, to another man who we'll be hearing more about, Marcus Tullius Cicero, the great Cicero, orator and writer, who's left us such a wonderful legacy of literature. Cicero was a rather mediocre politician, but he was, like most Roman authors, a man of public life. And this achievement of his in being elected as a new man to the consulship of 63 BC was to prove the pinnacle of his political career. But it was to be a difficult consulship and a controversial one. Catiline, having failed in the elections for the consulship of 63, began, it seems, to plot insurrection. In many ways, then, Catiline is very much a product of his age. We hear that he began to raise troops outside of Rome, and within Rome himself, he gathered around him, if we believe our sources, such a band of derelicts and brigands as the world has hardly seen. People completely depraved in character, lacking in funds, ex-slaves, slaves, and so forth. All of these people gathered, apparently, around Catiline's flag. There is some suspicion in our sources that Crassus had a hand in the conspiracy. There's some suspicion that Crassus was using the Catilinarian effort in yet another attempt to block the power of Pompey, which now was threatening to descend upon everyone from the east when Pompey returned. But the case against Crassus and his involvement in the Catilinarian conspiracy is unproven. Finally, through ways that we will not go into in detail, all of this, by the way, described in considerable detail in Sallust's monograph on the subject, which is part of your required readings. All of this was revealed eventually to Cicero, the consul. Cicero went into the Senate House and in a very dramatic speech denounced Catiline to his face in the Senate House. We actually have that speech. In fact, we have all four of Cicero's speeches which he gave on the occasion of denouncing and revealing Catiline's plot to the Senate and then to the people in the Tribal Assembly of the People. He was denounced, Catiline was denounced to his face and forced to leave Rome. He fled the city to his army outside the city of Rome in Etruria, the area north of Rome. And there, eventually, he was defeated in battle and killed. The conspirators inside the city of Rome were apprehended by Cicero, who stayed in Rome as the consul dealing with the situation there in the heart of the city. And they were imprisoned. They included some rather impressive names from the Roman nobility, men who'd obviously, I suppose in Roman terms, turned to the dark side. And as a result, these men were imprisoned and then summarily executed. This was to be, for Cicero, a source of some later grief. There's, by the way, a good story here in that the men were all, in the Roman fashion, they would have been strangled, garrotted, in this rather dark and nasty prison on the slopes of the Capitoline Hill, which you can visit today if you're ever in Rome. And the story goes that Cicero announced to the Roman people, awaiting news of the fate of the conspirators, their fate with a single word. Vixerunt, they have lived. He announced, that's pretty much the end of their story. The whole episode of Catiline's attempted coup d'etat is very illustrative of the stage that we've reached now, some 70 years into the Roman Revolution. Catiline is a Roman noble who tries, first of all, the constitutional route to get his way. When this fails, he raises an army. He gathers around him a bunch of desperados and people keen for what the Romans call res novae, revolution, new things, and tries to take over the state by force. We don't have to believe all the stories told about Catiline that he intended to burn the city to the ground and so on and so forth. They're probably accusations level for the sake of rhetorical effect. But what is interesting, and a feature of the Roman Revolution that often goes largely unnoticed, is the readiness with which there seem to be pools of people around who are willing to take up arms against the state as soon as someone raises the banner of insurrection. Marcus Aemilius Lepidus could find such people in 78 BC. Catiline had no trouble raising a significant army in 63 BC. And this reveals again something of another aspect of the revolution, one that's rarely appreciated, but the social and economic side of it. Once again, the Roman government is so absorbed with the constitutional infighting among the ruling oligarchy that they really are not paying attention to the basic running of the state. They're not paying attention to the issues that need to be dealt with. In many ways, they're abusing the very society that they're supposed to be guarding over. And as a result, there are plenty of dispossessed, disillusioned, destitute people wandering Italy, grouped in the countryside. Many of them are also to be reflected in the power of the pirates and the numbers of the pirates and brigands who are to be found in Italy at this time. And so when a desperate man like Catiline hauls up the banner of revolution, there will be takers who will be willing to risk everything for the purposes of taking over the state. So in many ways then, the attempted conspiracy or attempted coup d'etat of Catiline is reflective of the stage that we've reached in the Roman Revolution. What we'll see next time in the course of the latter part of the 60s and in the 50s BC is that Pompey's return from the east did indeed spark something of a revolution, but not in the way that many people expected it. There weren't to be proscriptions and mass purges of opponents, but through a series of incidents, a political revolution of sorts was to take place that, for many observers, marks the true end of the Roman Republic.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The History of Ancient Rome, Part 3. Lecture 25, The First Triumvirate.
Hello. Hello and welcome to the 25th lecture in the history of ancient Rome. The last time we examined the pivotal year 63 BC, we ended by looking at the conspiracy of Catiline. And we saw that that was a very important year for Roman history. It was the year in which Cicero was consul. Caesar made it to the chief priesthood of Rome and was elected praetor for the following year, for 62 BC. And there's another reason why that year is very important as well, because it marks the emergence in the Senate of a new group, a new die-hard group of conservative senators under the leadership of a young man, but an important one, Marcus Porcius Cato, who was a descendant of the famous Marcus Porcius Cato, the censor. These men are often distinguished by being described as the elder and the younger, Cato the elder and Cato the younger. This is Cato the younger. Cato was a backbencher at the time, but had emerged to some degree of prominence in the debate in the Senate on the 5th of December in 63 BC about the welfare or the fate of the conspirators in Rome. In that debate, most of the consulars, most of the ex-consuls who were asked to speak first, had voted for the execution of the conspirators, of the adherents to Catiline's plan who were captured in Rome, and wanted them all executed. Caesar then, however, got up and spoke. He made a very powerful speech against capital punishment and against the execution of the prisoners, and recommended rather that they be housed in various towns around Italy as prisoners for the rest of their lives. Now, life imprisonment was virtually unknown in the ancient world. They tended to only hold prisoners for as long as was required for them to face capital punishment, or they would go into exile or whatever. So this was a most novel suggestion, and Caesar in fact recommended it as being more severe than capital punishment. They would have the rest of their lives to mull over their crimes and recognize their punishment and so forth. His view was winning the day when Cato got up to speak and gave a firm and very stiff speech in which he argued once more that the Senate must act resolutely and that the conspirators must be executed. And remarkably, Cato, very much the junior partner here, carried the day, and his opinion was adopted. As we've seen, the adherents of Catiline in Rome were then executed summarily in the city. Now, the importance for that event is that it marks Cato now as a new spokesman, a focus for a much more conservative, traditionalist group within the Senate than we've seen so far. We've used the word optimates to describe people who promoted the traditional role of the Senate. From henceforth, the idea is, that term, optimates, optimates plural, is used generally to describe this very diehard group of no flinching, not an inch given to anyone. The Senate must act resolutely and it must be firm. Cato's prominence was further highlighted in the early part of 62, a year in which Cato was tribune. In January of 62, Pompey was still in the east with his army, and Catiline was still abroad in Etruria with his army in rebellion. A tribune for that year, 62, a man called Quintus Caecilius Metellus Nepos, it's a wonderful Latin name, came forward and proposed a bill, undoubtedly at Pompey's suggestion, that Pompey be recalled from the east with his army to restore order in Italy. And this would have given Pompey an excuse for coming back to Italy under arms. Cato realized the true intention behind the bill. And the meeting at which this bill was to be voted on is very interesting. It's a very interesting course of events and highlights Cato's personal bravery and his leadership of this new, very diehard element in the Senate. On the night before the meeting, Nepos's men occupied the forum and prevented any others from coming in who might vote against the bill. Cato, however, showed up with the group of his supporters, and on the speaker's platform, as Nepos was reading the bill, Cato issued his veto. "I intercede," he said. Nepos continued on reading out the bill to the people. Cato came forward and snatched the bill out of his hand and tore it up. Nepos continued from memory, and one of Cato's men came forward and actually clasped his hand over his mouth to stop him from speaking. A good example, by the way, of how the Republic operated on this face-to-face, very personal level. One had to do what one's office demanded of one directly. You couldn't send out others to do it for you. In the end, more supporters of Cato, who were impressed with his personal bravery, came forward, and the whole meeting ended in uproar and disorder, and no vote was taken.
Now, the importance for all this is that it meant that when Pompey came back from the East in 62 BC, there was this new element in the Senate, a new element that was behind a policy of a firm, resolute Senate that must act strongly against people who would seek to extract concessions from it. And so when Pompey came back, no longer with an excuse now to keep his army under arms, he disbanded it, much to everyone's relief, and returned to the city as a private citizen, something of a popular hero. Pompey had two basic demands, and neither of them were really surprising. He wanted, as any Roman general at this period wanted, land for his veterans, which by tradition, I suppose now going back to the period of Marius, would have been voted into place by means of a tribunician bill. He also wanted his eastern arrangements ratified. He wanted his settlement of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, which as we'd seen he conducted in 64 and 63 BC, pretty much as a monarch in the east. He wanted all those arrangements, those various treaties and the establishment of a new province and so on, ratified by the Senate and by the people. But he now faced a freshly emerged, vigorous conservative element led by Cato. Of course, Pompey also had other enemies in the Senate, Crassus, chief among them. And a very interesting man, one I just mentioned in passing, but who doesn't play a major role in the story, is a fascinating guy because he was so dissolute, by all accounts, a man called Lucullus, Lucius Licinius Lucullus, who was the guy who had been replaced by Pompey when Pompey had been voted the command of the East in 66 BC. So he hated Pompey because he felt that Pompey, his belief was that Pompey had come into the East and built on his own Lucullus's achievements and finished the war off that really Lucullus had won. So there were some powerful opponents to Pompey's return from the East, as well as Cato, who was at the head of this new conservative element. Basically, whenever the issue came up as to what to do about Pompey's demands for land and for the ratification of his eastern arrangements, filibustering took place. Cato would get up and start speaking and not stop until the meeting was over, and then no vote could be taken. What should have happened now, and what Pompey would undoubtedly have done, or would seem to have logically to have done, would have been to take a bill to the people and use a tribune. But the mob actually showed a high degree of apathy towards Pompey's demands. They didn't seem to be very interested in supporting him. And for whatever reason, he backed off. This is an interesting question. Why didn't he use the usual procedure of taking a tribune and now, at this period, using violence, beating his opponents off the streets, bringing his veterans into the city, and passing a bill through the popular assembly? He didn't do that. Maybe he was trying to curry favour with the Senate. It's hard to know, but he didn't do it. And the matter ended up lapsing. In September 61, Pompey was a popular hero. He celebrated a gargantuan triumph over the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Normally, a triumph lasted one day. Pompey's, in September 61, required 2 days to complete. He celebrated over no less than 15 countries which had been subjected to Roman power. He claimed that he'd founded 39 cities, captured over 1,000 strongholds, and he'd almost doubled the public revenues of the state. Multitudes of prisoners, and many of them kings and princes, were led in the procession. 20,000 talents of gold and silver were deposited in the public fisc. So, basically, in 61 BC, Pompey stands tall, head and shoulders, above his peers. But the burning issue of land for his veterans and ratification of the Eastern arrangements has lapsed, still has not been dealt with. The crux came in 60 BC, when Caesar came back from his pro-praetorship in Spain. Caesar had been praetor in 62 and then gone off to govern Spain in 61, and he came back in the summer of 60 BC. Caesar had spent his time in Spain bettering himself. He's reported to have had such massive debts that he's said to have claimed that he needed 25 million sesterces just to own nothing. He's also probably at this time said to have made the statement that a Roman governor required 3 fortunes out of his province. One to pay his debts, one to fund his future career, and one to keep. So this was his attitude as he went off to Spain in 61, and he certainly came back from that governorship with some military experience and some achievements under his belt, and financially far better off than he had been before he went over. He came back and he wanted to celebrate a triumph. He also wanted to stand for the consulship for 59 BC. He found himself blocked in both of these requests. His triumph was not voted. He had to wait outside the city. The traditional view was that general celebrating a triumph waited with his army outside the city until it had been allowed. Well, it wasn't allowed. And the time for the nominations for the consulship drew near. And one had to, of course, be there in person to declare one's candidacy. So Caesar had a choice. Either he could go for his triumph or he could go for the consulship. Rather angry, no doubt, he decided to go for the consulship and relinquished his claim on the triumph. This was a result of the blocking of Caesar's demands by the new conservative element under Cato in the Senate. Well, the results of Cato's prominence and the appearance of this new diehard element were catastrophic for the Republic. It's why I have spent time describing them. Because the result was to drive Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus into each other's arms. These men, who really should be rivals, and are, I suppose, were rivals, nonetheless felt that the Senate, this new, rather more firm Senate than they were used to, was something of a problem, and that they were better off pooling their resources. At some stage, probably after Caesar's election to the consulship in the summer of 59 BC, the three men met. It seemed that Caesar was the chief mover here, proposing that Pompey be brought in and join forces with him, and that Crassus, Pompey's old rival and Caesar's former patron, also be brought into the deal. This is an informal political arrangement that most modern scholars refer to as the first triumvirate. Now, technically, that's a misnomer, since a triumvirate was a legally constituted board of three men designed to carry out a certain task. When we look at, say, the second triumvirate, we'll see big differences between that legally constituted entity and this informal political pact between these three men. Still, for the sake of ease of reference, I'll refer to it as the first triumvirate, and I'll refer to the three men as triumvirs, although technically that terminology isn't accurate. So sometime between July and December of 59 BC, this pact was agreed upon. And effectively now, because of the obduracy of the newly conservative Senate, the three most ruthless and unscrupulous politicians and the most powerful men in Rome were working together instead of working against each other. And who were they working together against? The Senate. Marcus Terentius Varro, a contemporary and a scholar of the time, described the pact between Crassus, Caesar, and Pompey as the beast with three heads. And many ancient authorities, including Cato, looking back on these years later in his life, saw this as the true end of the Republic. This pact, this arrangement between these three men marked the end of the Res Publica. Because now it's the affairs of the three men who dominate. And it's their concerns that dominate politics. The existence of the triumvirate was made manifest in Caesar's consulship of 59 BC, and I want to spend some time on this because it's an extremely important, pivotal year. 59 BC, Caesar was consul. His colleague was a man called Marcus Calpurnius Bibulus. Things get off immediately to a bad start. In January, after all the ceremonies are over, investiture of office and sacrifices and so forth, Caesar calls a meeting of the Senate and proposes a land bill to settle Pompey's veterans. Few could actually find fault with the bill. It was a really quite a reasonable suggestion that had been done, after all, for the last 50 years. It wasn't as if this was a tremendously unusual demand. But Cato stood up and began to speak. After several hours, Caesar's patience snapped, and he ordered Cato to be arrested and taken off to prison, as was his right as a consul. As Cato was being led out, several other senators got up and walked out with him. And Caesar asked them, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" They said, "We'd rather be in prison with Cato than in the Senate with Caesar." He realized that he was not going to get anything out of the Senate, and so he resorted to plan B. For the rest of the year, Caesar employed the tribal assembly. Remember, there was a tribal assembly of the people that was virtually identical to the tribal assembly of the plebs, except that patricians were debarred from attending the tribal assembly of the plebs. But in essence, the tribal assembly of the people would be pretty much the same people voting. And consuls had the right to propose legislation to that body. This is what Caesar did. himself and a tribune, Publius Vatinius, in concert, proposed legislation directly to the people, either to the tribal assembly of the plebs or to the tribal assembly of the people. Caesar, as consul, for the rest of the year, didn't consult the Senate again. This is unheard of behavior. The consuls were the chief magistrates of the state, answerable to the Senate. He didn't even summon a meeting of the Senate for the rest of the year. These meetings, at which Caesar and Publius Vatinius passed through the various legislation that benefited Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, were marked by tremendous degrees of disorder and violence. We can say that, for instance, for the meeting at which the land bill was to be discussed, the normal procedure would be to have several informal meetings first to discuss the merits of the bill and then have a voting assembly to vote on the issue. At the informal meetings, Caesar summoned his colleague, Calpurnius Bibulus, and grilled him in front of the people as to why are you opposing this bill? Bibulus was made look foolish. He then, at a second meeting, he summoned who? Pompey and Crassus were asked, invited by Caesar to come and speak on the bill. And a very ominous moment took place. Caesar asked Pompey, what would you do if our opponents tried to block this bill with violence? Pompey said, if anyone comes with a sword, I shall come with my sword and my shield. Pompey was basically siding himself now with popularist politicians and endorsing the use of violence in Roman politics. But more disgrace was to happen. Finally, Caesar and his cronies occupied the forum to vote on the bill. Marcus Bibulus and various tribunes came forward to intercede their veto. As they were making their way up to the podium to intercede the veto, as the bill was being read out by Caesar and his supporters, Bibulus and his colleagues were manhandled. The fasces, the symbols of Marcus Bibulus's power as a consul, were torn from his lictors and smashed up on the ground, and he himself had a bucket of dung poured over his head. Humiliated and bruised, Bibulus had to retire. And Caesar had his bill passed. This is an example of the sort of behavior that Caesar and his supporters resorted to pass their legislation. This is more, in fact, like what a tribune does than what a consul does. Many contemporaries commented that Caesar as consul behaved more like a tribune than he did as a consul. Calpurnius Bibulus then withdrew to his house and stayed there for the rest of the year. He was besieged in his house. If he tried to come out, mobs tried to attack him. Mobs of hired ruffians. So he was forced to stay in the house. And he kept issuing edicts from his house, which would then be posted in the forum, as he commented on Caesar's essential sole rule of Rome during his consulship. Wags of the day commented that the consuls for the year were Julius and Caesar. Bibulus was basically boycotting politics, and many senators followed his lead and refused to even come into the forum. This, of course, only gave Caesar a free rein to do as he wished. Another attempt by Bibulus to block Caesar's behavior was noteworthy in passing. That is, he tried to declare that the auspices for every day that Caesar was going to hold a meeting, that the auspices were bad, and that therefore no particular legislation could be passed that day. Or, if it was passed, it could later possibly be annulled and declared void by the Senate. In other words, if the gods weren't on side when an important thing like a law was being discussed, then there was good reason to question the validity of the law. This, however, was just ignored by Caesar. As a result of basically ruling the state as he saw fit, Caesar and his tribunician crony, Publius Vatinius, passed varieties of legislations favouring himself, Pompey, and Crassus. Pompey got his land law and got his eastern arrangements ratified. Caesar, hungering for spectacular military glory, assigned himself a 5-year special command in Cisalpine and Transalpine Gaul and in Illyria, which is the area of modern-day, I suppose, Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia. And this would give him command of 5 legions and access to whole new fields of conquest. As we'll see, he took full advantage of those opportunities. Crassus got various bills passed favouring his purse, which seems to have been Crassus's main interest in life, going from rich to richer. Caesar's consulship then a pivotal moment in the late Republic. It displays unequivocally the unscrupulousness and ruthlessness of the politicians of the day. They're not afraid to resort to any means whatsoever to get their bills passed. Caesar tries the Senate, and when that fails, well, he just uses the people instead. If anyone argues, they're beaten up or humiliated in the way that Bibulus was. Really, in effect, from this point on, the Senate ceases to exert any kind of determinative role on events. Increasingly, this is the period that's sometimes called the era of the military dynasts. These are men backed by armies, working sometimes in concert, but often in rivalry, who determine the course of events between themselves. The Senate increasingly is an impotent bystander on events, despite the presence in it of a diehard conservative element under Cato. Following his consulship of 59 BC then, Caesar became proconsul over his new provinces and embarked on an enormous campaign. It took him 10 years in the end. He had his proconsulship, his special powers renewed for a further 5 years midway through his campaigns in Gaul. He took 10 years of his life to cover himself in military glory in Gaul. Those of us who have ever done Latin as schoolboys or schoolgirls in the past will be familiar with Caesar's De Bello Gallico on the Gallic War, which often was the first text used to introduce one into unabridged, unadulterated Latin. I'll talk more about that literary work in a minute, just summarize some of the main events of Caesar's conquest of Gaul. Many of the time considered this war immoral and illegal. Caesar basically moved in to the area of Transalpine Gaul with his legions and used a migration of a people called the Helvetii, who occupied modern-day Switzerland, to embark on not just the suppression of the Helvetii and the prevention of their migration, but on the conquest of all of what is essentially modern-day France, parts of Switzerland, Holland, Germany, and Belgium. Really, from the flimsiest of excuses, he embarked on a gargantuan campaign of conquest. His behavior during this time is not the most honorable, despite his attempt to justify all his actions. He's not afraid to go back on treaty agreements if it suits him. His main purpose throughout is to cover himself in glory and to basically outshine his fellow triumvirs and everyone else in the state as Rome's leading general, a position that Pompey had formerly occupied. I won't go into the details of his campaigns, but basically it was a remarkable achievement. Whatever about its motives and whatever about Caesar's behaviour, the sheer achievement of it can't be denied. It's common today, when period when Caesar's not the most popular figure in Roman history, considered to be a totalitarian and so forth, to play down the actual achievement of Caesar in Gaul. But it was a remarkable achievement. With a largely infantry army, he marched around these vast tracts of land, often facing huge odds, and emerged victorious. He brought Roman arms across the Rhine into Germany for the first time, and he also brought Roman arms across what the Romans called Ocean, the sea that surrounds the world. He brought it across the ocean, i.e. the English Channel, into Britain, and laid claim on Britain for Rome, which was later to be picked up a century later by the Emperor Claudius and used as the basis for a full-scale invasion and annexation of the island as the province Britannia. I think perhaps the most illustrative event to describe Caesar's achievement in Gaul is the Siege of Alesia in 52 BC, a time when Caesar, by the way, had a wonderful way of dealing with the Gauls. After about a year of campaigning, he declared that Gaul had been pacified. This meant that any further Gallic resistance to his invasion could be classified as rebellion, and so the people could be treated with utmost brutality if that's what he wanted to do. So finally, by 52 BC, it had dawned on the Gauls that this is what was happening to them, that they were going to be subsumed into the Roman Empire. And they organized under a very charismatic leader of a King Gatorix an enormous rebellion against the Romans. This came very close to actually seeing the end of Caesar and his army. But eventually Caesar emerged victorious. He besieged the Gauls at a place called Alesia in central France in 52 BC and erected simply mind-bogglingly complex and extensive siege works. Two lines of defences stretching dozens of miles, one facing inwards to keep the Gauls in Alesia, one facing outwards to prevent the relieving army, which he numbers at 250,000, from breaking in and relieving the Gauls inside Alesia. Desperate, desperate fighting took place over the weeks around Alesia. Basically, Caesar's army sandwiched between these two rings of fortification, but they emerged victorious and the Gauls had to concede that they were defeated. In terms of the historical importance, however, of these events, for Caesar, of course, they're extremely important in terms of his political position in Rome, but the historical importance also shouldn't be undermined. For the first time, Mediterranean urban civilization that had formerly been focused on the Mediterranean basin was brought up permanently into Northern Europe. And this, of course, had enormous effects on subsequent European history. So a very important event, the conquest of Gaul. We haven't got time to look at it in detail, but you can read about it in Caesar's own words, in his commentaries, as he called them. It's not a history. He didn't say that this is a history of his Gallic campaigns, but the commentaries, the notations. And they're presented, although they were composed in 51 BC, they're presented almost as if they were done every night as Caesar went to bed, and he'd write down what happened that day. They're presented in a very objective fashion. Caesar refers to himself always in the third person, which is something of an affectation, but it gives the appearance that one is observing from the outside. It's almost as if Caesar himself isn't there. He seems to be describing someone else's behavior. He never shows any emotion whatsoever in the course of this entire campaign. He never gets afraid. He's never uncertain. He's never happy. He just acts, always presenting himself as acting on behalf of the Roman state against capricious barbarians who have refused to accept that they've been pacified. The value of the commentaries in terms of evidence is, of course, overwhelming because we see the Roman army in the field in action as described by Caesar's commentaries, by the very commander. The discipline and organization of the Roman army shines through again and again. They're not afraid to build bridges, carry out enormous siege works or whatever is required of them. Hard, toiling, well-ordered units. But for the political purpose of Caesar, these are also extremely important documents. Because although they were proposed in 51 BC, we know that Caesar sent back reports from the front with which he kept the populace amused and which impressed the Senate and would have them vote him various thanks for his successes against the Gauls. Various ceremonies and so on voted to honour his achievements. And it seems quite likely, if not extremely likely, that these reports from the front form the basis of the commentaries. So that's a very important point to appreciate, that Caesar's commentaries should be read above all as pieces of political propaganda. They're designed to vaunt Caesar's achievements over, especially over his peers in Rome, Pompey and Crassus. And they are, rather than just descriptions of a campaign, a very important campaign for European history, they are broadcasts of Caesar's own political ambitions and of his military glory, which is now firmly in the service of those ambitions.
Lecture 26, Pompey and Caesar.
Hello again, and welcome to the History of Ancient Rome, Lecture 26. In the last lecture, we examined the events of 63 BC, basically down to 59 BC, and then we surveyed Caesar's activities in Gaul, which stretched on to 50 BC. He spent 10 years there in total. And what I want to do today is examine the developments in the triumvirate in the years when Caesar was away in Gaul, focusing mostly on events in Rome and the relationships between the three triumvirs. These were three men with towering egos and enormous ambitions. And the fact that they were nominally allied doesn't mean that everything was lollipops and roses in the garden. Ultimately, there was going to have to be some kind of a showdown. And in fact, in the period that we're going to look at today, taking the story down to 49 BC, we'll see that that's precisely what happened. Caesar's achievements in Gaul themselves, monstrous as they were, caused some degree of jealousy and tensions within the triumvirate. And this is perhaps brought out to some degree in the career of a very interesting man, Publius Clodius Pulcher. Clodius was actually a man who was born of patrician stock from the family of the Claudii. And under Caesar's consulship, he had successfully petitioned and been transferred to the plebs. This required him to be adopted by a plebeian family. So he adopted the name Clodius, which is a plebeian version of Claudius. He did this specifically so as he could stand for the tribunate. He wanted to be a tribune of Rome, and in fact in 58 BC he was just that. And his behaviour in 58 and 57 BC is well worth looking at, because it illustrates something of the tensions that existed between the triumvirs, especially between Pompey and Caesar. Clodius is generally seen as an adherent of Caesar's. It was under Caesar's consulship that he'd been transferred to the plebs in order to meet his ambition of becoming a tribune of the plebs. And some of his actions seem to be in Caesar's interests. But in my view, Clodius and Caesar had a much more shadowy and loose relationship than many might assume. And I'll hope to bring that out as we look at the behaviour of Clodius in the years 58 and 57. Clodius basically learned the lesson from Caesar from 59 BC. He learned that hired gangs of thugs go a long way to controlling the state. And he perfected, almost brought to a science, the use of hooligans and riffraff to beat all opposition off the streets and control assemblies of the people. He proposed various acts of legislation, first of all, to make himself popular with the people. He was popular with the mob because he took a stringently anti-Senate stance, was a fiery orator, and he was possessed of a vulgar and irreverent sense of humour, which the mob really appreciated. And in 58 BC, for instance, he was the tribune who proposed that the distribution of grain to the mob be somewhat changed in a way that was to have great effects in future Roman history. We had seen that starting with Gaius Gracchus, there had been proposals that grain be sold to the people at a rate less than the common market value. Well, in 58, Clodius took that a step further and proposed that grain be distributed free at state expense to the mob. This was enormously popular, of course, and set Clodius on his career, along with his thugs, of controlling, basically controlling Rome for 18 or so months between 58 and the middle of 57 BC. He then seems to have gone after associates of Pompey. The most obvious and prominent example is Cicero, who was, I suppose, nominally in Pompey's camp, but was also a personal enemy of Clodius. This is why I believe the relationship between Clodius and Caesar is a bit obscure, because Clodius had his own motive for going after Cicero. It wasn't necessarily that he was following Caesar's instructions to try and humiliate or undermine Pompey's position in the city. He had his own reasons that go back to 62 BC in a rather comical incident where at a religious festival reserved for women in honour of the Bona Dea, a rather obscure goddess, the good goddess, Bona Dea, which was taking place in Caesar's house in 62 BC, Clodius had been discovered in drag at this particular religious festival. And this was considered to be an enormous scandal because it, of course, undermined the value of the religious festival and showed up something of Clodius's rather perverse sense of the world. Cicero particularly had interrogated and humiliated Clodius in no small measure at various public meetings, and Clodius hated Cicero as a result. They were, in the Latin, inimici, personal enemies. Well, in January 58, Clodius wasted no time in getting back at his enemy. He proposed a bill, of course, with his hired gangs, making sure that the bill was passed immediately, that any person who killed or ever had killed or ordered the killing of a Roman citizen without due process should be subject to prosecution. The bill has clearly ended Cicero as consul in 63 BC, his supervision of the execution of the conspirators of Catiline in the city. Cicero realized that his case would be lost, and he left Rome voluntarily in March of 58 BC to go into exile. Clodius then turned more aggressively on Pompey himself. This is a more troublesome issue and requires us, I think, to pause and examine a bit more closely Pompey's character. Pompey's an enigmatic figure in many ways. He was Rome's leading military man, and had been since the 70s BC, and he seems to have lacked what we would term, I suppose, the killer instinct. He wasn't a man who was as hungry for power as Caesar was. Following, for instance, following the consulship of Caesar in 59 BC, in which Pompey had received most of what he wanted, he'd got land for his veterans, he had had his eastern arrangements ratified, he withdrew from public life. He seems to have sort of sat back in his laurels in a way that Caesar would have considered unconscionable, to sit back and relax in this way. Now, one reason given in the sources for this is that in 59 BC, Pompey had married Caesar's daughter, Julia. And she was 30 years younger than he was. And in our sources, she kept him quite busy. And that Pompey enjoyed this and liked to just sit back and relax. For whatever reason, Clodius, in this sort of downtime that Pompey was displaying in 58 BC, took aim at the great man. Now, if he did so at Caesar's request, it seems to me highly unlikely. Caesar has little real reason to directly attack, order Clodius to really go after Pompey on a personal level. It's a different matter undermining Pompey's position subtly by attacking some of his friends, but to focus on a man who's nominally your political ally and is in fact your son-in-law, to aggravate him like that, it doesn't seem to me that that is terribly logical. And Caesar was, above all, absolutely logical and clear-sighted in his ambitions. It might just be that Clodius wanted to square off against the most powerful aristocrat in the state. He wanted to test his own power with his mobs against Pompey's. And so, various incidents took place in 58 and on into 57 that drove Pompey even further from the public eye and encouraged him to stay in. Whenever Pompey would come into the forum, for instance, Clodian's hooligans would follow him, shouting vile insults in his way about his relationship with his wife and so forth, mocking him. In August of 58, we hear that a slave of Clodius's was discovered wending his way through the crowd with a sword hidden in his clothes, making his way toward Pompey. This seems to have frightened Pompey sufficiently, and he withdrew from public life. Spent a lot of time in his villas outside the city of Rome. In this way, then, Clodius basically ruled Rome for the next year or so. Pompey did little or nothing to block his movements. It's a really curious case. He just seems to withdraw from public life in a way that, as I say, Caesar would have found unconscionable. This is a big difference between the two men, by the way, that we will see again in the future. Eventually, the situation in Rome did become so intolerable with Clodius's gangs basically ruling the state. I mean, this is really a sort of a sorry spectacle to see the mistress of the Mediterranean ruled by street toughs, which is basically what was happening, that eventually Pompey decided to strike back. The attacks upon Pompey became too intense, and as a result, he organized his own gang of thugs. He decided to fight force with force. And with the tribune of 57 BC, a man called Titus Annius Milo, he organized a gang of roughs to take on Clodius's roughs. And for the next 5 years, these two gangs of thugs basically faced off repeatedly in and around the center of Rome. Public meetings became increasingly disordered. Violence now was almost the norm. And the situation really was quite degraded in the Roman Republic. The revolution had reached new levels of disorder. Nevertheless, Milo's, or at least the appearance of Milo's guerrillas and thugs, seemed to have the desired effect. Clodius's power was somewhat checked, so that, for instance, in 57, in August or September of that year, Cicero was recalled from exile by a law passed in the centuriate assemblies. The tribal assemblies had become almost unworkable because of the disorder and violence that was associated with them. Cicero came back from exile more of a conservative than he had left. All of these circumstances, the behavior of Clodius, remember he was perceived as an adherent of Caesar's, raised tensions considerably in the triumvirate, and the Senate, led now by Cato and increasingly by a more conservative Cicero, sought an opportunity to drive a wedge in among the triumvirs. They began to propose that Caesar be recalled from his province and stand trial for his behavior as consul in 59 BC. Pompey, allegedly, nominally,